I would like to thank Professor Anne Cheng and the Collège de France for the opportunity of being part of this conference on this very important theme. And I feel truly honored that Professor Cheng has described my book as the inspiration for this conference. So thank you very much. The instant we recognize violence as an important and intimate part of human experience, the way we look at history, the questions we ask, the answers we seek, all change dramatically. In my recent book on the subject, I examined political violence in ancient India between 600 BCE and 600 CE, with special reference to the state's punitive role, war, and interactions with the forest. I pointed out that all traditions, including the religions of nonviolence, Jainism and Buddhism, accepted that a certain amount of violence was necessary for kings. I argued for a connection between the growth and systemization of state violence and the increasingly sophisticated attempts to mask, invisibilize, justify, and aestheticize this violence in various ways. At the same time, I pointed out that ancient Indian political discourse consistently distinguished legitimate force from illegitimate force and kept open a window for interrogating the state's violence. I also argued that what is distinctive about ancient India is not that ancient Indians were especially non-violent people, but that ancient Indian political thought displays a unique, intense, and prolonged engagement with the tension between violence and non-violence. In this paper, I would like to take some of the arguments further. It is difficult to draw a dividing line between the threat or use of coercive power or force that is necessary and that which is illegitimate or disproportionate, that is violence. Assessments will differ depending on perspective. So I am aware that when I use the words force and violence, they are fluid categories, difficult to pin down or define in absolute terms. Over the centuries, political theorists have justified the state's coercive, punitive, and military powers and have argued that it is these powers that stand between order and anarchy. In terms of their perspective, almost all the sources available for the history of political ideas and practice in ancient India are statist and centrist. The theories of the origins of kingship emphasize the king's responsibilities towards his people and describe taxes as his wages for the protection of his subjects, for the preservation of the social order, and the prevention of crime and violence. The king's just punishment prevents a descent into what is called the law of the fish, an anarchy where the mighty devour the weak. My paper has three parts. First, the justification of the use of force in ancient Indian theories of kingship. Second, the assertion of the state's right to punish, torture, and kill. And third, the anxieties of political theorists about the problematic nature of kingship and political power, and the awareness of the violence, the possibility of violence against the state. In my conclusion, I raise some general issues, including the relationship between political theory and practice, and the possibility of a global comparative history of political violence. The first part of my paper. Here I look at theories of the birth of kingship. And I look at two texts. One is the ancient Sanskrit epic, the Mahabharata, and the other is a Buddhist account of the origins of kingship in a text, in a series of texts called the Tipitaka. The Shanti Parva of the Mahabharata offers two accounts of the origins of kingship. The first takes us back to a wonderful age of perfection when kingship and punishment did not exist because they were not required. However, men fell prey to error, confusion, and greed, and they approached the gods Brahma and Vishnu to intervene. The god Vishnu produced a mind-born son, Virajas, and this man was followed by two other individuals. But none of these three men wanted to rule because they were inclined towards renunciation. And I'd like to emphasize that renunciation is a very important aspect of the discussion of violence and nonviolence in ancient Indian thought. The next king, named Ananga, did agree to be king, and he ruled well, protecting his subjects, meting out justice. And he was followed by another king who knew and learned the art of governance, but he did not have control over his senses. The issue of the control over the senses is also a very important part of the ancient Indian theories of kingship. These men were followed by a king named Vena, who was dominated by passion and hate and was unlawful in his behavior to his subjects. The sages decided to get rid of this wicked king, and they stabbed him to death with blades of kusha grass. They churned his right thigh, and out of it emerged an ugly man named Nishada. Nishada is a word for a forest tribal. And this man was told to go away because he was not considered fit to be king. Then the sages churned the right hand of the murdered King Vena, and from that emerged Prithu, a man with a refined mind, an acute understanding of the sacred texts, of the military arts and politics. This King Prithu was consecrated by the gods and sages, and he proved to be a good exemplary king. The second account of kingship, or the origins of kingship, in this Shanti Parva part of the Mahabharata describes kingship as the result of both divine intervention and a social contract. We are told that people were oppressed by anarchy, violence, and insecurity, and that they came together to make agreements among themselves to get rid of those men, those aggressive men who stole, who violated women, and performed other such evil acts. However, this arrangement did not work. So they went to the god Brahma and begged him to appoint a king who would protect them and whom they would honor in return. Brahma chose Manu, but Manu refused. He said that he was afraid of the cruel acts that he would be obliged to perform if he became king. And he said that kingship was a very difficult task, especially among men who were prone to improper behavior. This is when the people stepped in, and they urged Manu not to be afraid. They assured him that the sin incurred by his cruel deeds as king would go away. And they also promised him that they would give him 1/50th of their cattle and gold and 1/10th of their grain. They said that soldiers skilled in war would follow him around everywhere, and 1/4th of the merit earned by people. Merit is also an extremely important part of the ancient Indian discourse on kingship and ethics in general. And they said that 1/4th of the merit earned by the people would go to him. Manu accepted this pact and went around the earth, we are told, suppressing the wicked and making them perform their duties. Let us now turn briefly to an early Buddhist account of the origins of kingship. This is the Aggana Sutta of the Digha Nikaya. This begins in a primordial age of perfection when beings were undifferentiated, luminous, made of mind, feeding on rapture. At some point of time, a decline process set in, primarily due to greed. Theft, accusation, lying, and punishment appeared. And the last straw was when one being violated the private property of another by stealing rice from his field. The beings assembled and lamented this situation. They approached the one among them who was the best looking, charismatic, and authoritative, and asked him to protect property and to punish those who deserved punishment. In return, they said they would give him a portion of their rice. So here again is a contractual theory of the origins of kingship. In all three accounts I have discussed, kingship originates in violence and disorder. It emerges as a critical institution, the only option essential to bring violence and disorder to an end. All three accounts emphasize the king's duties towards his people, the maintenance of social order, the protection of private property, and preventing and dealing with crime through the imposition of punishment. It is not just the origins of kingship, but the continued existence of this institution that is considered essential to maintain order and prevent anarchy. But there are some interesting differences between the accounts. The Buddhist text talks about a straight social contract between the people and the king. In the first Mahabharata account that I mentioned, the gods and sages play key roles. And in the second account, it is the gods and the people. In contrast to the Buddhist account, the beginnings of kingship in the Mahabharata are less smooth. The institution has a bad start, and there are various problems before it receives a firm foundation. There is an acknowledgement of the possibility that kings may have serious flaws, that there is something inherently problematic or negative about the institution of kingship, that those who inherit it may turn their back on it and may not want to rule. In the first Mahabharata account, kingship is born in the midst of regicide, renunciation, and evil. In the second, it requires the king's overcoming his own fears of the cruelty and sin that are inherent in the discharge of his duties. The second theme of my paper, the king's right to torture, punish, and kill. Theories of the origins of kingship describe punishment as a primary duty of the king, but also assume that this punishment must be just. In the Mahabharata, Bhishma tells Yudhishthir that the royal rod of force was created by Brahma, the god Brahma, for the protection of the world so that people perform their duties. Everything depends on it. Describing this punishment or danda as a terrifying monster with many arms, legs, tusks, and eyes, Bhishma states that it inspires fear in people, and it is this fear that prevents them from killing one another. The nature of transgressions in which the king is obliged to intervene are of two types: a more general transgression of the prevailing social status quo, and then there are the more specific crimes of a civil or criminal nature. The most direct and poignant example from ancient Indian texts of a ruler killing a subject in the first kind of transgression comes from the Ramayana, the epic, the second well-known Sanskrit epic, where the otherwise compassionate Ram kills the Shudra Shambhuka. The moral justification for this killing is that there was the premature death of an innocent Brahmin child in the kingdom, and the reason for this unfortunate event was traced to the fact that this lower class Shudra Shambhuka had violated the class or varna norms by performing austerities. Such a violation could not be tolerated, and the otherwise compassionate Ram had no hesitation in killing Shambhuka for the sake of the greater good. The text that discusses the role of the state in intervening in specific types of civil and criminal offenses, and the state's right to impose retribution, pain, and torture on subjects in the administration of justice is Kautilya's Arthashastra. It has often been compared with Machiavelli's The Prince, but I think it's a much more elaborate discussion that we get in the Arthashastra, and Machiavelli should actually be described perhaps as the Italian Kautilya. The types of punishment mentioned by Kautilya include fines, confiscation of property, exile, corporeal punishment, mutilation, branding, torture, forced labor, and death. Kautilya accepts torture as a means of acquiring information during interrogation, as well as a part of punishment. And the types of torture include those that involve striking, whipping, caning, suspension from a rope, and inserting needles under the nails. Some of these pale in comparison, I think, with modern torture techniques, but that is besides the point. The Arthashastra also asserts the state's right to take life on the ground of justice. It distinguishes between simple death, Shuddhavadha, and death by torture, Chitravadha. The death by torture refers to especially painful deaths, which may have also involved public spectacle. The varieties of death by torture include burning on a pyre, drowning in water, cooking in a big jar, impaling on a stake, setting fire to different parts of the body, and tearing apart by bullocks. However, all the texts emphasize that the king's punishment must be measured in accordance with proper judicial principles, proportionate to the crime, and utterly impartial. Of course, all people are not considered equal in these texts. They are divided into different categories on the basis of varna or hereditary class, and in other ways as well. So we are told that like the spring sun, the king should be both gentle and harsh, especially in matters related to punishment and taxation. The Mahabharata connects the king's proper administration of justice with his afterlife. A just king goes to heaven, an unjust king goes to hell. So it is fairly simple and straightforward. The third aspect of my paper, something which I did not look at in my book, but I have become increasingly interested in, and that is the issue of resistance and rebellion against the state. The Mahabharata is a text that ultimately upholds the institution of kingship and the use of necessary force. At the same time, it warns that the excessive cruelty and violence of the king and his neglect of his duties can lead to justified violence against him. We have already seen that regicide is built into one of the Mahabharata stories of the origins of kingship. Remember the evil king Vena, who was stabbed to death by the sages with sacred kusha grass. Further, the epic tells us that a cruel king who does not protect his people, who robs them in the name of levying taxes, is evil incarnate and should be killed by his subjects. A king who, after promising to protect his subjects, does not do so, should be killed by them as though he were a mad dog. So if the king does not perform his duties and is cruel to his subjects, the Mahabharata sanctions regicide. There are several references in ancient Indian texts to evil kings. Vena is one, Duryodhan of the Mahabharata is another, and there are others also. Some of these are mythical kings, others are historical, some are rulers in the divine realm, and there are references to their being justifiably killed. The reasons for their being killed include their moral failings, such as greed, injustice, lust, and evil deeds. Should such stories be read as a warning to kings against transgressions, or were there endorsements of rebellion? Notwithstanding the references to the killing of kings, the overall political discourse of the Mahabharata upholds the king's position and punitive powers. However, there are several other indications that the upper class male composers of our texts recognize the possibility of critique, resistance, or rebellion against the state. The fears and anxieties of these composers and the elite, the political elite, are writ large in the idea of the Kali Age, part of the cyclical theory of time. The Kali Age, the fourth evil age, descriptions of which talk about how it was basically a world turned horribly upside down, where people violated their class duties, where farmers did not pay taxes, so on and so forth. The Arthashastra is unsentimental and sanctions all the killing, mutilation, torture, and capital punishment necessary for the administration of justice and for the protection, maintenance, and enhancement of the king's power. It is also acutely aware of the potential sources of violence against the king. The text is paranoid, or you might say realistic, about assassination, especially the dangers of assassination through poison, and the queens and princes head the list of potential assassins. The harem in the Arthashastra is a very dangerous place. Kautilya identifies many other potential sources of violence against the king. He talks about enemy kings, neighboring kings, disaffected, angry subjects, forest tribes, mlechas. Mlecha is a word that includes tribals and foreigners, and mutinous troops. He talks about the dangers posed by conspiracies, traitors, and enemies. He discusses revolts in the interior and the exterior. He discusses how internal and external enemies can be killed, and many of the strategies involve secret agents in disguise. He also advocates secret killing, silent punishment, upanshu danda, in the case of those who cannot be killed openly, for instance, treasonous high-ranking officers. And Kautilya does say that silent punishment can also be used against hostile subjects. The Arthashastra prescribes violent punishments for crimes, violent crimes against the king. The punishment for one who reviles the king, reveals secret counsel, or who spreads evil news about the king is that his tongue should be rooted out. More serious crimes against the king invite more serious punishments. Death by setting fire to the hands and head is the punishment for one who covets the kingdom, who attacks the king's palace, who incites forest people or enemies, who causes rebellion in the fortified city, or who incites the army. In many instances, including crimes which invite mutilation, punishments can be commuted to a fine. But unless there is some crucial mitigating factor, no commutation is possible where the crime merits the death penalty, especially in cases of treason or loss to the state. Interestingly, although varna, or hereditary class, is central to Kautilya's understanding of society and law, capital crimes against the state and king are discussed without reference to social class of the parties involved. Crimes against the state are thus seen to be a separate category, where the social background of the defendant is more or less irrelevant, and where the state commits no wrong in imposing the death penalty, cutting across varna lines, except for occasional concessions being made to Brahmins. One of the most interesting references in the Arthashastra is to there's a word called prakriti kopa, anger of the people. And the references to the anger of the people in the Arthashastra are quite interesting. It shows that the political theorists were aware of the possibility of a rampant mass rebellion or mass resentment, even though we have no actual historical records of such an event in ancient India. It's also interesting that Kautilya understood the importance of what James Scott has referred to as hidden transcripts long before his time. He suggests that secret agents fan out to different parts of the empire and listen to the private conversations that individuals were having with each other to sniff out any scent of possible dissent or treason, and then to take very firm steps. Again, something that reminds us of the importance of surveillance in our own times. Although the Arthashastra is usually seen as a text upholding the totalitarian state, the entire discussion in the text is premised on a recognition of the fragility of the king's power and the constant threats to his life and position from many quarters. It is a graphic acknowledgement that the ruler was constantly the potential target of the violence of others. Kautilya advocates the ruthless, carefully calculated and calibrated and effective use of preemptive and post facto violence by the state in order to prevent and counter violence against the state. Ethical issues are subordinated, in fact, are irrelevant in the face of pragmatic political calculation. So a text which describes the dizzying heights of power to which a ruler could aspire also presents him as an insecure, vulnerable figure who lives in constant danger of being undermined or killed. In this respect, the discussions of general issues in normative texts may actually give us better insights into political realities and processes than the enumeration of the so-called factual details that we get in our sources. When the cracks in the normative views become visible, a more fractured and contested picture of ancient Indian politics emerges, one where the onward march of state and empire building is accompanied by a recognition of their instability and fragility. I would like to end my paper by raising three general questions related to the study of political violence, and perhaps this will tie in with some of the issues that will emerge from the discussions in this conference. The first question is, what impact did the political ideas discussed in normative texts, such as I have described, what impact did the political ideas discussed in these texts, including theories about the origins, nature, and functions of kingship, have on political practice? Did the life of these ideas begin and end within the pages of a manuscript? If they did have a life outside these texts, how influential a life was it? How effectively did these theories bolster political and social hierarchies? What was their political and social impact in a context where multiple theories existed and where the issue of dharma itself was fraught with complexity and confusion? I can only answer this question or these series of questions partially in the limited time available. And the answer includes the fact that we have royal inscriptions which refer to some of these elements in the theories of kingship, which refer to the king as the maintenance of social order and refer to the importance of the king's punitive powers. So there are some inscriptional references that suggest the permeation of the ideas in these texts and into the political ideology that we find in royal inscriptions. We also occasionally hear echoes in the inscriptions of the contractual theories of kingship, but these are very, very few. Whether the theories of kingship were ever invoked by rebels is a question that is more difficult to answer. In fact, we have no evidence that the Mahabharata sanction of regicide was ever used by rebels in early times to sanction their activities. And there are various reasons, perhaps, why recorded instances of rebellion of various kinds, except for contests within the political elites, succession battles. Apart from this, we do not really have many instances, historical instances, of certainly popular rebellion. The second general issue that I would like to raise is as follows. The factors that define violence and the normalizing processes that make some kind of harming or killing by the state or against the state seem justified are deeply embedded in social and political structures, institutions and ideologies, as well as in moral and religious values. Debates on violence in ideologies or movements associated with non-violence deserve especially close attention. My own investigation of early Buddhist and Jain texts indicates that the religions of nonviolence recognized the necessity of the use of a certain amount of force in the political domain. The renunciatory traditions that privileged nonviolent ethics seem to have lost their nonviolent edge when they engaged with politics. But the existence, the embeddedness and strength of these renunciatory traditions did, I think, provide an important philosophical and ethical resource that political practitioners had to acknowledge and could not completely ignore. They made violence and nonviolence issues that had to be addressed, even if there was a general consensus that absolute nonviolence was impossible in the political sphere. The third issue. Our heightened sensitivity towards political violence in our own time lends a great urgency to investigations of violence, as Professor Cheng has emphasized in her introductory remarks. But it also presents us with a problem. To what extent should the ancient past be used as a resource to deal with our troubled present? Does the use and abuse of history in contemporary political battles make the discipline more relevant than ever before? Or does it threaten to destroy the objectivity that is an essential part of the historian's craft? These are old questions, but an exploration of violence in ancient India and in other societies and in other times undertaken in our all-too-violent world urges us to re-engage with them. Finally, without essentializing cultures and without falling into the traps of cultural bias or chauvinism, there is the interesting possibility of having a comparative history of the ideas and practice of violence and nonviolence, one which identifies qualitative differences in forms, structures, intensity, ideologies, and attitudes related to political violence across cultures and across time. Thank you.